Welcome to FIC Focus, where Bloomberg Intelligence fixed income, credit, currency, and commodities strategists and analysts discuss their short and long-term views on debt markets and issuers. Now, here's the Bloomberg Intelligence FIC research team.
Welcome to the All Options Considered podcast. I'm Tanvir Sandhu, Chief Global Derivative Strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence. Thanks to those who joined us in London on March the 19th for the first Volatility Forum. This episode is the recording of my opening speech from the event, where I cover macro and volatility across markets, and the discussion from the first panel on VIX and option strategies. Enjoy.
Welcome, everybody. It's good to see everybody here and everybody who's joining online. I'm going to cover volatility across rates markets, followed by the FX and the equity space. I became interested in options at university, particularly given my focus on mathematics and judging outcomes in a probabilistic way rather than a deterministic manner, given the complexity around the economy. The key feature of the last 2 years has been rates vol has been elevated relative to equity and FX, and there's been an historical gap with rates vol essentially absorbing the macro uncertainty. Since the regional banking stress in March last year, we've seen equity and FX vol decline. Rates vol has remained high, but in the last few months it has come in, given that the market is now zoning in on when the central banks are going to start cutting rates. But it still remains elevated. It's around 100 basis points in the US and around 70 in Europe. So rates vol still remains elevated. And essentially what's been going on is the rates market has been the shock absorber of macro uncertainty. And equity markets are pricing a soft landing. The FX market is essentially being paralyzed. So there's push and pull factors going on with FX. The dollar's lack trend and carry's been the main theme in the FX space. As we move forward, the most pronounced part of volatility in the rate space is at the front end of the curve, and this surface is showing the swaption surface, so it's volatility on rates across tenors, across time, and we can see that at the very front end of the yield curve, which is the most sensitive to policy rates, that's where the highest volatility is. And at the moment, it's really been supported by macro uncertainty. There's different measures of how we can look at macro uncertainty, one of them being the FOMC participants' judgment around uncertainty, around their projections compared to the last 20 years. It's come down. It still remains elevated, and it's actually elevated relative to non-crisis periods. Another measure is looking at the Livingstone survey. So that looks at the dispersion of economic forecast. And for real GDP, it was at 40-year high. Another way to look at this is the disagreement amongst forecasters around policy rates. And this has been overlaid with the orange line, which is the implied volatility on the two-year yield. And it follows it pretty well. Essentially, we need to see a narrowing of expectations around policy. And as soon as we get that narrowing, rates volatility should continue to move lower. Typically, what we see after the last hike, so this is for the Fed, volatility has typically declined. And there are a few exceptions. For example, in the 83-84 cycle, volatility remained elevated given that after the last hike, we had a sharp cut. So this is looking at the skew in the rates market. So essentially all it is looking at volatility on rates going up versus rates going down, that difference. So plus or minus 25 basis points. So the blue line is that skew at the very front end of the curve. And it fell in March last year, given the regional banking stress, and it's not really come back. And it's justified by the fact that at the very front end, there is a lot of asymmetry now. So there's much more room for rates to decline at the front end of the curve versus moving higher. And if we end up with a hard landing scenario, for example, you know, one of the safest places in the world is going to be the two-year Treasury bond. So that remains as it is. The counter to that is the fact that the economy in the US has been resilient, so it may not be realized. If we go further out the curve, so the white line, the purple line, looking at the skew on 10-year and 30-year rates, that's still in favor of higher yields. And we've seen inflation beating in the US recently. The distribution has shifted somewhat to being a more symmetrical outlook for policy rates. The back end of the curve still points to higher rates. And we've seen that move over the last month that where yields have gone up. So moving on to FX. So FX, you know, has been very low. It's in single digits. And if you compare it to the others, you know, it has been, particularly against rates, it has been very low. The key feature of FX markets over the last 2 years has been carry. I mean, that's what's been making money. So, you know, the high yielder being the dollar against the other low yielders. So carry's been the trade. There's been no trend. The blue line represents trend. So that's not been doing particularly well. And like I say, the dollar is effectively being trapped. Last year, the theme was US recession, lower dollar, etc. It didn't materialize. So carry continues to be the theme. And it can continue to be so. So as long as FX vol remains low, it can suck in more money. And the poster child of carry is the yen. So today we saw the Bank of Japan raise interest rates for the first time in 17 years. However, you know, shorting the yen, shorting dollar yen specifically, you know, is very punitive given the carry dynamics. But buying topside dollar yen, so call options, the carry is, actually works in your favor. And dollar yen topside can be quite interesting against the right tail of inflation in the US. Dollar yen's really moving with dollar rates. BOJ is just kind of there on the peripheral because their rates are so low and everybody else is up here. So the fact that implied vol has moved down in FX is permutated out the vol surface. So convexity pricing, that's pricing of tail risk. That's compressed and it's pretty much at record lows. And it makes a compelling argument of having some of that in a portfolio for diversification benefits. Looking at US election risk, if, for example, Trump wins the election, it could pose downside risk for Europe in the sense that we could see the funding to Ukraine being cut and either direct tariffs on Europe or indirect via China. And that could bring down both StockX 50 and Eurodollar. And the correlation is currently, you know, slightly positive. It could move up. So you have a vanilla option that's historically very cheap. You could add on a condition that actually cheapens the option further relative to the vanilla option, but you need two things to happen at the same time. There's a lot of noise out there about VIX being low. Is VIX cheap? Is VIX expensive, etc.? And if we look at 2023, the realized volatility of the S&P 500 was 13.5. And that was a lot to do with the low correlation in the index. And if we look at the long-term median of the realized vol, it's not far off. Is VIX cheap or expensive? Well, we have to look at it through different prisms. So looking at the performance of option strategies on the S&P 500 year to date, so the index is up roughly 8%. Adding a put has eaten into that. So the green line is 95% monthly put systematic. So adding that, slightly eating into those returns. A buy right index, which is the orange line, the BXM, that is, you know, underperforming quite a bit. So that's where you own the index and sell a 1 month option and roll it on expiry, a call option. Going back to 2022, it's quite interesting to look at what happened then, given the market was down 18.1%. And looking at how these strategies performed, adding a put, so that's the green line, actually was worse than just owning the index. So adding a 95% monthly put systematically while owning the index, you were worse off than just owning the index itself. Now, keep in mind, this is all systematic. So those who are more tactically inclined would be, there'd be different iterations of this and they'd be monetizing downside at different points. In general, this gives us a sense of where things were. BXM index, which is the buy right index, that's the benchmark for buy right, that actually was 7% better than the index in 2022. So it kind of tells you the kind of environment that we had it in 2022, as well as going forward, is that the market was grinding lower. So volatility wasn't particularly performing well, even though we had an 18% decline in the market. It's almost the inverse of escalator up and elevator down, because by the dip, it remains pretty strong. So one of the reasons that people point to why index volatility is so low is the growth of ETFs that do call overwriting. And that you can see since COVID that the AUM into these funds has ballooned. And the reason being, that strategy actually outperformed the index in 2022. The other reason being, if you think that the valuations of the market are high and you don't think there's much upside left for the index, then you enter this kind of strategy where you overwrite. These strategies have increased for that reason. Whether it's contributing to the decline in the VIX, I think it's not that big. The real reason is fundamental reasons of low realized volatility. We can look at it through a different lens, which is the volatility risk premium. So this is the VIX minus subsequent 1 month realized volatility. So if we take that difference of where implied is versus realized, you know, that's effectively the risk premium. It's been in the zone of long-term averages. So it doesn't really allude to that vol selling has contributed in a significant way to why the index vol has declined. It's more fundamental. So, and this is one of the ways we can figure out if, you know, the VIX is actually trading quite low. That premium is, you know, pretty much in the zone of long-term averages. So it doesn't tell me that VIX is cheap. Optically, the number might look low, and it has been clustering at optically low levels. However, this premium is at reasonable levels. So the total option volume in the US has been hitting record highs. We saw in February, daily volume of US listed options hit record highs. Call option volume last year in February hit a record given the chase for the upside in the market. In December, following the FOMC meeting, that was seen as a dovish pivot. Then we had another record in call option volume. So there is this chase for the upside. Another thing that was quite interesting last year was that the open interest of VIX hit all-time highs, and it was driven by call options. And essentially, VIX optionality is a bet on tail events. And historically, what we see is when implied volatility moves down, demand for call options on the VIX goes up because there's an appeal of convexity. So when you have low levels of vol, you know, there's more chance that it can double, quadruple, etc. So low levels of vol amount to basically higher levels of interest in call options. So if we look at the reactivity of VIX, so changes in the VIX to S&P returns, it's been pretty poor, right? If you look at that dip there in 2023, that was due to the regional banking stress in the US. So it did wake up. However, it's gone back to not being that reactive. And that's where, when we look at ideas about non-convex hedges versus convex hedges, non-convex being, for example, put spreads versus having an outright put, you need to understand kind of the environment we're in terms of volatility of whether your hedge is actually going to pay off. And that feeds into the skew. So this is the difference between put vol minus call vol, and it's normalized by at-the-money vol. So we can just purely see the skew. So it's for, you know, the market declining versus the market rallying. Key feature of 2022 with the skew was that it actually declined significantly, and it goes back to the reactivity of volatility. There's a lack of reactivity. When the market was declining, it was just grinding lower rather than elevator down. So it revived in 2023. So we had this round trip, and that was back to the, you know, the US regional banking stress woke the skew up, and it was driven by the put side. And then subsequently, it's come back down, given that there's been the chase for the upside, and buy the dip remains prevalent. There's going to be reluctancy for market makers to actually markup there, implied vols, and we may end up where the skew just remained flat for a significant amount of time. Convexity, so when we talk about tails, in this case, we're looking at VIX minus the 1 month implied vol on S&P. One of the features after COVID was convexity stepped up into a higher range, and it was stuck there for a couple of years, given the amount of uncertainty and the shock to the economy, the greatest shock to economics that most investors have ever seen. So it was stuck there for a couple of years. It has subsequently come in, and that goes back to the fact that the reactivity of volatility to the declines in the market aren't particularly great. So one of the other features is the high dispersion of stocks that has weighed on index volatility. So AI has clearly been driving that, and market concentration is very elevated. The fact that there's high dispersion under the surface of the index, that is weighing on index vol. And to finish on, 0 days to expiry options. So this kind of activity has ballooned. It makes up now roughly 50% of the total S&P 500 options volume. And if we look at just the S&P options volume, it's roughly 25% of the total market cap of the S&P 500, so roughly 10 trillion of notional, not risk, but 10 trillion of notional. 50% of that is options that trade and expire on the same day. And there's a lot of questions about, is this adding to fragility of the market? If we have a sell-off, will this exacerbate it? This will be discussed in panel two. What I've seen so far, I don't think it's adding fragility. There's no evidence of significant selling of tails, and that's where we could have increased fragility. A lot of the risk seems well balanced. I don't see much risk there at the moment. And on that, I'm going to hand it over to Anna Edwards, who's Bloomberg anchor and acting London Bureau Chief, for panel one.
Thanks very much, Tanvir, and hello, everybody. Thanks so much for coming here to Bloomberg. Yeah, I'm spent most of my time on Bloomberg TV, or up until recently, and recently taken on the role as acting London Bureau Chief as well across all of the news universe here at Bloomberg, but here in London specifically. So it's a real pleasure to be here and to host this panel for you. The subject of our panel, cross asset options strategies for 2024. I'm really pleased to have with me on the stage here Pierre Dessart, partner and head of alternative investments at Dominice. Tom Leek is with us, head of solutions at Capstone Investment Advisors, and Valeriu Trufas, fund manager at Atlantic House. So we'll start by allowing them a moment to just introduce themselves, introduce their strategies, and broadly what this panel is going to do is pick up on quite a few of the themes that Tanvir was just talking about and dive into them and get the perspective of the panelists as to what they think, so you get some more views in the room. So food for thought for the coffee break later. So Pierre, if I come to you first to sort of give us your a minute or so on your role and your strategy.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for being probably the first person to pronounce correctly the name of the company.
Excellent.
For the last 10 years, I've been doing this.
Tick.
We're Dominice. We're based in Geneva. We've been operating for 20 years now a Vol-Arb strategy called Cassiopeia. What we do there is that we are basically actively trading mostly equity index derivatives using a mix of a systematic and discretionary approach.
Hi everyone, Tom Leek from Capstone. Very happy to be here, very excited for the discussion we're going to have. So Capstone is a hedge fund, about 12 billion in assets. There's two main activities. There's the main fund, which trades derivative strategies across asset classes and across regions. And then there's the solutions business. Within the solutions business, we help investors deliver outcomes using a lot of volatility type strategies, but also a lot of other derivative strategies as well.
Hello, thanks for the invite. I'm Vali Trufas. I co-manage the uncorrelated strategy fund at Atlantic House. We implement in this fund strategies, the name uncorrelated refers to the low correlation to the traditional asset classes like fixed income and equities. And we achieve that by implementing systematic strategies of volatility carry and other carry, as well as systematic strategies of vol convexity or convexity protection for the tail scenarios.
Okay, so we know a little bit about where you guys are coming from. I'll encourage you all to get involved as well, as we saw with Tim earlier on the app or the web browser we were using. There is the facility to ask questions. I have a screen in front of me. I can work some of those questions into the conversation. So please do that. I'll encourage the panelists to jump in if they want to vehemently disagree or agree or anything else, really, just to sort of jump in on the conversation so we get as much out of this next 36 minutes or so as possible. And what we'll do first is pick up on one of the key themes that Tanvir was talking about there, about whether the VIX really is that low. He went through some arguments as to why you can argue it isn't. But if we... Tom, do you want to start on that one? And then
sure.
We'll throw
think,
it all around.
I think we covered it pretty well. I think there's... it's a very interesting year. Because most years you see investors generally interested in protection strategies or generally interested in carry strategies. And actually this year is one of those rare years where you see interest in both. And that sort of suggests that it's neither like screaming too high or screaming too low compared to investor sentiment. And as Tanvir showed, right, the implied realized spread is not huge either way. So I guess the sort of follow-on question is why is realized vol so low, right? If implied vol is sort of in line with realized vol, do we think that the current low level of realized vol makes sense given the overall macro backdrop? I think that's the sort of natural follow-on to that first question.
Yeah, and is it all explained by that lack of realized vol, or are there other things in the mix?
I think you covered it well. There's a bunch of technical factors as well, particularly the call overriding. That's clearly a big factor as well.
Okay. Pierre, your thoughts on whether the VIX really is that low?
I mean, it's... Of course, it's not that low. I mean, anybody who's, you know, can look at the chart in 2017, that was like really, really low. I mean, this was, you know, a year where we saw for extended period VIX being below 10. So there is a lot of room to go. Clearly, as, you know, as Volarb specialist, we're not so much interested by whether it's low as to whether more it's, you know, cheap or expensive. It's not, I mean... Clearly, in a lot of cases, vol tends to be expensive. But as Tanvir showed, you know, the spread is in is still positive. It's less attractive, and you could say that for almost any vol premium that is on the S&P 500 these days. It's a bit less attractive than it was last year. So something, you know, clearly there has been some compression, but I mean there's a long way to go till it becomes really, really cheap.
Okay, so not really, really cheap, but cheaper than it was. Vale, do you want to weigh in with your thoughts on whether it's low?
Yeah, just to pick up from Pierre's thoughts, vol was very low in 2017, and we know that 2018 we had the Volmageddon, right? So me, I'm a risk manager by background, so I always think, is this a year when that can happen again? And it's important to look at the flows. And Tom mentioned that the overwriting strategies flows. And I think it's important to look at the mechanics of how those flows are being replicated, right? And we think that the overwriting calls are being replicated through a long gamma or equities are being bought when they're going down and sold when they're going up, which is kind of lowering the volatility. Whereas in 2018, the mechanics were completely the opposite, where VIX was being bought as it was going up. So in that sense, we feel like the flows are the other way, and we don't think that a 2018 type of event is comparable.
So we're not set for Volmageddon Mark II?
We don't think that's comparable with what we have at the moment.
Yeah.
If I may... bring a different perspective from what we're seeing, vol is actually staying quite firm on this rally that we had right now, right? There's an interesting sequence. If you look at vol as a Volarb trader, you know, you're not so much interested by the level of VIX, but you're more interested to measure what your vol surface is doing. So you can think about it as, you know, looking at the implied vol of a fixed strike. It's more pertinent for a vol guy. And so what's happening is that as the market is rallying, you know, the VIX resets actually slightly higher since the start of the year. And I think that's actually a good point to show that there is demand for protection right now. And I don't think that, you know, coming back on the gamma trap question, it's we're not in a gamma trap. I don't think we're in a gamma trap. There's real demand for protection. And I see the vol being firm consistently. And as a matter of fact, you know, inside the fund, we run about 20 different strategies. And if I look at the net vega of our position, you know, more often than not, we're leaning short vega. Since, you know, over the last 3 months, we've been, you know, long vega 60% of the time. Through, as I said, different investments, but that's I think that's a sign.
I think the demand for protection is worth talking about. It's important to remember that equities are still very high, right? It's like it's been a very, very good period for pension funds, both corporate pensions, where they've actually made money like over this period and on both the asset side and the liability side, but also state funds, which don't have the liability side. It's really been a good environment for them. And so you're seeing a lot of those actors looking to lock in those gains and sort of de-risk generally, particularly on the corporate side. So I think there remains this steady bid for defensive strategies, for protection strategies, driven by institutions who are in good shape generally and want to try and lock that in.
Okay, and maybe we'll touch on that a little bit later in our conversation as well. Going back to something you said a moment ago, Tom, you know, obviously the next question that comes from, is it low? Is there going to be something that changes in realized vol? I mean, this takes us into other territory perhaps, but do you assume there will be, or do you assume that things stay the same?
So I think it's, we don't claim to be particularly good at macro forecasting, right? We're like volatility market structure guys. And so we all agonize over our macro forecast and then try and think about the structure and ignore the macro forecast. But it is, I guess I would say that it's surprisingly low from a macro perspective, right? Given everything that's going on, I'm personally surprised. Yeah. But it isn't like I can say, oh, I definitely have a strong macro view one way or the other. That's not our space.
Well, are you surprised at how low realized volatility is given, you know, wars on a number of continents?
Well, at the end of the day, equities are driven by the earnings, right? That's the fundamentals, and that's the better catalyst for the equities to be driven by, right? And when the earnings are good, equities will rally, and we know that rallies happen at a lower volatility than crashes. Mm-hmm. And with that background, it's not surprising that vol is below the average. VIX is 14, it's realized is 13. The long-term average is, 19, right? So it is below the long-term average, but it's not 9, right, as it was in 2017. And I think it's a healthy level. S&P is all-time highs, and it should be lower than the average.
Pierre, do you spend much time thinking about realized vol, or you leave that to others?
Yeah, you know, when I brush my teeth, when I shave, all the time. No, but it turns out we actually have a bit of macro view at Dominice because we're also managing a multi-asset portfolio for private clients. Our view is that, you know, we're, you know, at the start of an equity bubble. And so we
only
think
the start, not the middle?
Well, not quite. No, we think the equity market is going to continue to rally, and as it does, everything's going to become more shaky. And you're starting seeing that also in the way the S&P 500 moves, because although the close-to-close vol has been, you know, fairly contained within, you know, inside the day, which is, you know, something that also impacts you when you run an option book, there has been some substantial swings. And so that's our take on it. So we see for the at least the next, you know, 3 months, a continue of the rally and also vol staying firm on the back of that.
Okay, yes, we wanted to talk about dispersion trading, so maybe we'll get to that in just a moment and a bit more on the bubble. Sticking with whether it's low, whether the VIX is low or not, and most of the people agreeing with Tanvir, there are real reasons for it, and maybe you don't describe it as low. But what about whether it's expensive or not? Pierre, I think from what you said earlier, you'd have views on whether you can argue it's expensive.
Let's put it this way. It's you're seeing a spread, right? You're seeing something like a 2-vol spread. On that thing. I mean, since the start of the year, I think VIX has averaged something like, you know, close to 14, and realized vol has been around 12. So there is definitely a spread, okay? But that spread is harder to capture than in the past. I think that's the key. And I'm not sure I would go for S&P 500 if I wanted to do the carry game. For instance, you take something like DAX, which hasn't moved iota in the last 4 or 5 days, right? I mean, moves has been, you know, below 20 bips. And so I think that if you want to try to carry that premium, diversification is super important. And the areas where we like to be invested for that specific trade, I think Europe is great because most of the action happened in the US, actually. And so during European hours, you know, things tend to be quiet. There's always an accident once in a while, but typically we're seeing better returns there. And I think also smaller indices work well.
Mm.
I would double that. I think diversification is key. The carry trade works. I think last year it worked in 99% of the days, put it that way. But it's key. Sizing is key in terms of, you know, what can go wrong and what's the stress event that's the most adverse. And but at the end of the day, it's a very valid strategy.
Mm. So taking a slightly different angle, just away from like vol carry, I think the price of optionality does look attractive compared to outright directional trades, right? So I do think we've got a whole set of clients and also in some of our own investments where we're thinking of replacing like outright positions, either long or short, with outright calls and outright puts. And I think there's no need to overcomplicate it, right? Like options look relatively attractive compared to history, compared to the moves, maybe not on a day-to-day basis, but certainly over longer horizons, right? The market has been fairly trendy. And so literally, keep it simple, replace some of your equity with options. I think it's a nice entry point at the moment.
Yeah. Does it require making sense of what's happened in rate expectations over recent months and what that has or has not done to the VIX? Is that a useful exercise? Because there's been so much, you know, some asset classes have just managed to ignore the fact that at the start of this year, we were expecting, I mean, was it 6? Rate cuts, I forget, we've lost so many, but it was 6. And now down to 3, maybe we find out tomorrow it might just be 2, and yet that doesn't create volatility.
Well, I think it's a good point, but it didn't really create volatility last year either, where we went through a sort of similar changes in expectations over the year. And as I just mentioned, right, vol carry worked super well. So the continued disconnect between the equity market volatility and the rates market volatility goes back to my prior comment where it's surprising it's so low. Mm. But there isn't actually a mechanism for these two things to link, right? They are different markets. They don't have to be agreeing with each other. There's really no clean arbitrage between them. So, it is, again, surprising this disconnect between rates and equity and why equity is so low. And rates, as we saw in the earlier charts, is definitely not low. I agree. It's a good question.
And that, I like Tanvi's point saying that the rates volatility has absorbed all the market's action. And that's right. You know, we've all seen it. And it was interesting to see how we could actually monetize on equity vol carry. But in the same time, in our fund, we've been long the interest rates vol up to September. I think end of September, October, when it got to a level, it was at the same level as the global financial crisis levels, if you looked at the rates volatility, and at with the euro crisis levels, right? So at that point, it became a highly asymmetric payoff in which we kind of went neutral, took out a long rates vol strategy. And we know that it now came off quite a bit, and I think it's somewhere in the middle. I don't have a view on rates vol at the moment, but the
rates vol, just like equities, is kind of in line with realized. But I just think the interesting observation is if you're hedging a 10-year bond, which is sort of like what people hold asset side in rates, it now has sort of like a volatility similar to equity. And that is a definite regime shift change, right? I think that's probably a new normal, but it is still a big shift in dynamic between, it used to be much, much cheaper to hedge your rates risk than your equity risk. It's no longer the case.
Okay, so that's a new normal. Hedging rates risk is now...
I'm not saying people are actually hedging it. I'm saying if you want to, it costs roughly the same as hedging your equity.
Sure. Pierre, any thoughts on the rates environment and how that has or has not affected volatility? or our expectations of the rates environment, because they've changed a lot, even if, you know, the actual rate hasn't.
See, I shouldn't have said that I had the macro view.
Yeah, earlier. We're going to come to you every time.
Frankly, I don't have a strong view on that. I guess for me, what's really crucial in terms of, you know, whether we're going to be successful in our investments is whether there's demand for protection. Mm. I think that's really where what is key. We hold a very small position in rates vol. It's a very small fraction of the book, and so I spend more time trying to find signs on, you know, whether there is demand to protect the equity side. And I think, you know, as Tom said earlier, there is actually something to protect this year. And I think also the idea that you should not overcomplicate things, that's also very, very true. Overlays are working fine, and I see also a lot of opportunities there.
I think we touched on this a little earlier, but let's just revisit whether huge positioning in short vol is taking us into any kind of volatility trap. We maybe had some thoughts on that already. Is that something anyone wants to spend some time on? And if it does start to crack, what does it look like if it cracks, Vale?
Yeah, to me, we touched earlier, so it's the flows that's been mentioned, that there's a Bloomberg article, very good Bloomberg article last week, I believe there's the overwriting call strategies, right? And that's something that, in order to replicate it, you buy low equities and sell high equities, right? And that will temper down the volatility in the extreme case of large volumes, right? So that's, as such, is kind of vol coming off argument. What can go wrong is perhaps a forced unwind of that call overwriting strategy, which, frankly, I don't see that much, because I don't think it's a leveraged call. I don't think it's a leveraged trade. This trade is typically put on by long onlys, who are massively long equities. They want to enhance their yield a little bit by overwriting calls. You know, if they lose a little bit on their calls, it's not something that they'll be taken out by margin calls or anything. It's just unleveraged strategy. So I don't see that forced unwind danger there.
So I'd agree with the, we spend a lot of time worrying what could actually trigger a forced unwind vol event. And I agree, we don't really have it like a clear model, unlike the VIX ETN experience, which was much more clear how it was going to play out. This one, it's really hard to see a mechanism where you get a forced unwind. But the flip side is the strength of these products is still, like, it's very impressive, and it's surprising, honestly. Like, if you look, Tammy mentioned it, like, 22 was a good year for these products. And so a lot of these products have been sold on the benefit of the outperformance they generated in that slow drawdown year. But 23 and year to date, they haven't really outperformed, right? The market has done much better without the call overwriting element. And so it is, I don't know, there's some recent data suggests that it might be starting to taper off, and maybe you're starting to see a little bit of a decrease in size. But it is, the investor commitment with these products is surprising, and I think I'm not sure it will last if the market continues to perform how it's been performing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's attractive, right? People love getting a coupon, because this product, actually, they pay a coupon every month. So it's one of these human biases where, you know, if somebody gives you a bit of money every month, you're very happy. I agree. And if you push the logic further, you know, what could trigger outflows from this product? It's either they're massively outperforming on the way up, which I think they will. If you take JP, for instance, they buy more defensive stocks. They don't buy really the S&P 500. They don't try to track that exactly, so they try to be more defensive. And so I think, you know, probably currently they're underperforming. And on the way down, I mean, if you have a substantial correction and people just back out from equity as a whole, there you'll see some outflow. But where I agree with, you know, what has been said is that it's not a Volmageddon scenario because it's an overwriting strategy. Most of them are overwriting calls, which are upside. And so what happens is that as soon as the market starts shifting down, you lose that exposure, which means that you also have a bit less supply of gamma from this product, but it's not going to be a forced unwind like you know we saw during the Volmageddon. And so
but I don't see a smoking gun. I'm sure the fact all of us have agreed will also make all of us even more nervous that there's something that we're
yes. Yeah.
It's like consensus, everything's fine. That's not usually
that's not
a healthy situation.
Place, not a comfortable place to be. Well, let's take that thought and apply it to equities, shall we? Because, Pierre, you were saying earlier about stocks being in a bubble, and I wanted to go on to talk about dispersion trading. But that, you know, maybe makes more sense when you think overall stocks are doing one thing and individual names are doing another. So selling or buying the index versus index components. Tie that thinking around that into your view that we've got a bubble in stocks.
Okay, so, yeah, dispersion. how is that linked to a bubble? Let's think.
Or your thoughts on why you think it's a bubble. Let's start there.
Well, I mean, because of the way the vol is behaving and because everybody can see the valuation, you know, fundamental valuation, high PE and so on, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can smell the greed, right? Bitcoin is up. Everybody's getting excited about NVIDIA. But really, it's the vol behavior which we've been able to map to other previous moments where there was also a very strong rally. Dispersion is maybe an odd one. Dispersion, the situation with dispersion, if you have the implied correlation and the realized correlation, which is low. So when you put on that trade, whether you do it vega neutral, which means you have the same amount of vega on the index versus the single stock, or whether you try to actively capture the correlation premium, which would lead you to have slightly more short index vega as a single stock vega. In both cases, you're exposed to the implied correlation component. And so you are in a situation now where you have something realizing super low, like if you want to take an image, I think even in 2017, implied correlation and realized correlation were not as low. So this is at more extreme level than VIXs, for instance. And so that's a bit scary, but the trade is working. Mm. I think after that, it depends a lot on the finer details of the implementation, whether you have, you do it systematically with some discretion, whether you have the exact basket or whether you try, for instance, to build a basket that has a maximum exposure to, factors like momentum, value, and so on. There's a lot of variation.
So picking up on this, just a quick, is it a bubble comment? So my 13-year-old son goes, Dad, have you heard of the stock NVIDIA? And like, I don't know if it's a bubble, but that's like a clear indicator, right? It's like, should I buy it? And I was like, anyway.
This was not official advice.
It was advice he was giving me. And then on dispersion. So the dot-com bubble was actually a pretty good period for dispersion, right? So when you actually have different sectors performing differently, dispersion strategies can do well because dispersion is high.
And don't we have that now with tech stocks doing so well? And they're like,
clearly we do. But as Pierre just said, the actual entry level is also priced very low, right? So correlation is priced very low, dispersion is priced very high. And so when you're doing that trade, it's an implied versus realized trade. And so what matters is not just the fact that there's going to be high dispersion, it's what entry level did you put it on at. The correlation is both the implied and the realized is very low, which interestingly is sort of like in line with what we've said, right? We said that was the same for equity volatility. Tamir said it was the same for convexity. Most derivative parameters are actually realizing roughly fair. But they're all quite low, which is an interesting repricing of risk. One comment which is worth just mentioning a little bit further is the S&P is getting very concentrated, right? So because the returns are being driven by a small subset of the market, the portion of the market which is made up by a handful of tech names is extremely high, right? Mm. So I saw a stat, and I may not get it exactly right, but it's something like 40% of the market is now driven by a tech-type type sector. And this is important for volatility because when you're actually looking at the volatility of the S&P, you need to remember that the S&P has changed because of the weightings of the stocks within the S&P. And so actually, if you look at the constituents of the S&P now versus historic constituents, you'll find that the current constituents are actually the most volatile set. So the changes in the weights is increasing the expected volatility, even if the single stocks volatility stay the same and the correlations stay the same. Just the weight changes the index volatility. And it is, as the index gets more and more concentrated, you would expect realized volatility to go up. And it's not clear that's really fully reflected in the market just yet, right? It's like most people look at the S&P and think it's the same asset. But you have to remember underneath what's in it is changing, and that needs to be reflected in your volatility forecast.
And so do you position for that level of concentration to continue to be the same or to...
When does the bubble end?
Mm. Yeah. That's the million-dollar question.
And it's a good remark, and I think that's one of the reasons why, for instance, the vol of the NASDAQ and the S&P have started to converge. They are less apart than they used to be.
Mm. I would nuance on the tech. You're right that the tech is now a big weight in the S&P, and we are saying that the tech are doing well. Actually, if you're doing the whole stats, that most dispersion stocks were Nvidia on the positive end, and Apple, believe it or not, on the negative end. In the last 3 months, Apple has been the underperformer of the S&P by index points, which means, and obviously Apple is going through its life cycle, and which means that there is dispersion even in the tech sector,
yeah.
And to the point that the dot-com bubble was a dispersion period, dot-com was not backed by earnings. Let's say that. Let's just state it. Here now we have a tech sector that is backed by amazing earnings, right? So these are all real, not just promises on a paper. And yes, definitely backing. I think both Pierre and Tom mentioned that it's all about execution. At this point, we think that. The systematic just full 500 stocks versus S&P is not as good a trade than if we pick the stocks, pick the baskets, and there can be better entry points for.
We've got a question on dispersion in the audience then, listening to what you're saying, and this goes back to whether, the big question about whether it changes, I suppose, but are you thinking it's time to take profit on long dispersion then? Who wants to pick up on that one?
I don't think it's time to take profit. So there's like always, like in all trades, there's a clear buy, there's a clear sell, and there's unclear, right? I think dispersion works. Now it works less as a systematic basket of 500 stocks or all the stocks. I think it works better with a picked basket, thematic basket. Going the other way, it's not something I would do systematically. Maybe more discretionary, but not on the systematic side.
So, actually, there's something you could do. You could think about reducing the index side of your dispersion trade. Hedging it, maybe either reducing it if you're theta neutral, or actually buying tails, because as we just said, just buying calls and puts out of the money is actually not that expensive.
No.
And so I would look at minimizing that short leg on your
on that important question of whether
position.
There's a bubble, and that seems to lead to the answers to so many other things that we've been talking about around realized volatility and all sorts today. Other than looking for coverage in mainstream newspapers of Nvidia or asking children if they've heard of it, which I think is actually a very interesting point. What else are you looking for? And maybe it's behavior in options markets. Maybe that's where you're looking for clues. But what are you guys looking for when it comes to sensing when that happens? Pierre, do you want to?
Sorry, I missed the beginning of the question.
Oh, just where do you look for signs that the bubble turns, that it... I was saying that, you can take soundings from the general public, and that's quite useful because, you know, when all retail traders are in on something, you maybe draw conclusions.
So I can wait. So we do a lot of defensive strategies, terrorist hedging strategies, and we get asked, I don't know, maybe only once a month, can you please build something which times this defensive strategy, right? Which is basically what you're asking.
Yeah.
When should I have it? When should we not have it?
Yeah.
And I've like we say no, right? Because it's like
it's a fool's errand.
It's honest.
And also the problem is
it's very client friendly.
It's
here.
Like it's we can just like telling someone what they need to hear rather than what they want to hear. I would call the right type of friendly. But I hear you. They don't like it. But it is it's a very hard problem, and you also have asymmetry in your risk return of actually trying to do it, right? Because the time you get it wrong. Behaviorally is really bad, right? Everyone experiences losses much stronger than gains. Mm-hmm. So telling your management you have a hedge and then discovering at the month you needed it, it wasn't there, is really a problem. So I would say this is extremely difficult and has massive asymmetry for the person who's trying to do it. So please.
Thanks. Thanks for this 1 minute of reflection. There are some metrics we look at, of course, but I think the trick is not to try to time it perfectly. The trick is not to, when the water goes away, that, you know, still have your bath suit on.
Be fully clothed.
It's more a question of being process-oriented and not, you know, taking stupid risk. I give you an example. One of the super popular strategies these days in the QIS space is selling far out of the money puts naked. And there's a mechanism for hedging this intraday. And if you look at the sharp of that thing over the last 2 or 3 years, it has a sharp of close to 4, okay? We have the opposite position of that. This is the stuff we actually buy. And so we're negative a sharp of 4 on that thing, but we have to buy it because exactly for what, you know, Tom just said, you don't know when it's going to happen. Right, and so I think it's you need to put yourself in a position. It's about picking the correct risk reward, if you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. And so 100% agree. Yeah. Build a strategic allocation to cheap stuff. Find cheap defensive stuff over time. Don't try and do the timing game.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We in our fund we also implement systematic strategies. We have the protection sleeves on in just in case that happens as well, and the fund is meant to do well in normal times as well as being protected in the really extreme scenarios.
Maybe this links in. I've got another question from somebody in the audience. What do you see as the most popular defensive tail strategies? Anyone have thoughts?
Most popular.
So that's clearly not the question, which is like, what do we think is the best, right? So the most popular is people do rolling vanilla put options, right? So 15% out of money quarterly or annually. I don't personally think that's a particularly good strategy. I think you can do a lot better. Mm. And I think you can get similar degrees of protection quite a lot cheaper than that sort of static implementation. Now, all of that said, right at this moment, we've sort of said it, the actual fixed strike options are pretty cheap, right? So actually right at this moment, the sort of popular buy vanilla put options is not a bad option. It's if you look at our portfolios, we don't usually have a lot of that type of stuff on the defensive side, but we have more than we normally do, simply because it's cheap at the moment. Keep it simple, just buy the thing.
Anybody else on most popular defensive?
Yeah, agreed. At the moment, and Tanvir touched on skew as well. If you would put spreads on, for example, the puts themselves are cheap, but if you put a put spread on, it's even cheaper. And for I think this was mentioned for fund managers who already have a good yield from other sources, you know, spending a little bit and getting that protection on, it's like a no-brainer. Even though we understand that in a long term, this will cost money, right? But it's that peace of mind, that protection, because the yield is coming from somewhere else.
Okay.
I don't know what's popular or what's not popular. All I know is that if I was forced to take a hedge, I would rather own put spread on the S&P than call on VIX.
Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, very much. We are out of questions from the audience, but I'm sure...